From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. How did one of America's most offbeat performers end up on America's most popular sitcom? Why did she pose nude in Playboy? And does she still want to be Barbara Streisand? On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Sandra Bernhardt, and she'll read to us from her new book. Also today, Dr. Kevin Cahill talks with us about his 30 years of experience in developing countries, dealing with the consequences of war and natural disaster. He's edited a new book about the role of health and human rights organizations in shaping foreign policy. And critic Maureen Corrigan reviews The Art of Fiction, a collection of literary criticism by novelist David Lodge. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Congressional Democrats have reached agreement on nearly all the elements of a deficit reduction package, but Republicans are still working to defeat it. Every Republican in the House and Senate voted against the plan in the initial round, and the GOP is encouraging wavering Democrats to oppose it as well. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Republicans cheered the news this weekend that Oklahoma Democrat David Boren is switching from a yes vote to a no vote on the president's plan. That means Democrats must find another vote to pass it in the Senate. Meanwhile, advertising campaigns have been launched in the states of senators who are wavering. Conservatives are targeting Herb Kohl of Wisconsin with television ads. President Clinton will make his case for the plan on national television tomorrow night. Meanwhile, Senate Minority Leader Bob Dole is arguing that the plan will actually hurt the economy.
The glue that holds the Republican Party together is the absolute conviction that the United States cannot spend its way into prosperity and cannot tax its way to prosperity.
The House and Senate will vote on the plan later this week. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
United Nations officials confirmed today that the Bosnian Serbs used helicopters in their capture of a strategic mountain overlooking Sarajevo. The attack was a violation of the ceasefire agreed to by Serbian leaders last Friday, and the use of military aircraft would be a violation of the UN no-fly zone over Bosnia. Bosnian President Alija Izetbegovic refused to attend the Bosnian peace talks in Geneva today until the Serbs agreed to withdraw from the mountain. Serbian leader Radovan Karadzic said his forces have agreed to let UN troops take over the captured territory. The intense fighting in Bosnia could cause a setback in the peace talks in Geneva. Mediators at the talks say that would be tragic because they say a settlement is so close. The BBC's Kathy Jenkins has been following the talks.
For the mediators in Geneva, a day of negotiation has been lost. The Bosnian president, Ali Izetbegovic, demanded that Serbian forces withdraw after their offensive around Sarajevo. The Bosnian Croat leader, Mate Boban, for his part, strongly protested to the UN about Muslim offensives in central Bosnia and alleged massacres against Croats. The official conference line in Geneva is that progress has been made in the negotiations to draw up a map splitting Bosnia into three republics. But President Izetbegovic said the Muslim-led Bosnian leadership would not accept the 30% of territory on offer from the Serbs and Croats as part of a negotiated deal. He also refused to consider the idea of splitting Sarajevo into two, as demanded by the Bosnian Serbs. It's our firm stand, he said, that Sarajevo cannot be a divided city.
Kathy Jenkins for the BBC. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 22 points to close at 3,561. Advancing issues led declines. This is NPR. Defense Secretary Les Aspin said today that the Clinton administration will help speed up the process of converting closed military bases to civilian uses. Aspin repeated the president's pledge to speed up environmental cleanups, help local officials get information about base conversions, and make it easier to transfer base ownership. Aspin met today with members of Congress, mayors, and other local leaders to discuss plans to help communities that face economic upheaval because of the base closings. A former Florida congressman was sentenced to prison today on campaign and income tax violations. Doug Phillips reports from Miami.
Former South Florida Congressman Larry Smith will spend 3 months in prison and 2 years on probation for failing to pay $37,000 in federal income taxes and lying on campaign reports about $10,000 of campaign money that went to pay a casino gambling debt and other personal expenses. Smith's attorney, Neil Sonnet.
Larry has accepted full responsibility for his wrongdoing. He's made that very clear before and during court today.
In remarks to the judge, Smith choked back tears and said he broke the law because of extreme financial pressures. It was a stupid decision, he said, adding, I'm not proud of what I did. After five terms, Smith retired from Congress last year as authorities were investigating his financial dealings. For National Public Radio, I'm Doug Phillips in Miami.
The Federal Trade Commission is going after one of the biggest debt collection agencies in the country. The FTC accused Payco American Corporation of questionable practices and is asking a federal court to fine the bill collector as much as $10,000 for each offense. The allegations include dunning people at their work, calling their homes at odd hours, using foul language, and falsely threatening to have debtors arrested. All the allegations are violations of the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Lots of people don't know what to make of Sandra Bernhardt. When is she serious? When is she putting us on? When is she in persona? And who is she when she's just herself? On the Letterman show, she was wild. From her hit off-Broadway show, Without You I'm Nothing, you got a sense of her as someone who has always been infatuated with show business and imagined herself in the shoes of everyone from Barbra Streisand to Prince. Now that she's a regular on Roseanne, she's reaching a mass audience and, for better or worse, getting the fame she always dreamed of. But being on a popular sitcom is not stopping her from pursuing her own idiosyncratic vision. Sandra Bernhardt has a new book of short stories called Love, Love, and Love. Before we talk, here's an excerpt of a piece in which she offers her experienced advice to the new crop of young beauties in Hollywood. She tells them how to deal with a business run by short, frustrated men.
So how do you handle it, short of getting an attitude? Use some psychology. If you sense hostility coming from a casting director or fat, unattractive producer, just pretend he's your uncle and humor him. Take him into your confidence and make him feel as if it's you and him against the world. Talk about football or your favorite cocktail. Guy talk. Like, I've got $50 on the Broncos. I think they're going to kick some butt. What about you? Don't act all girly and giggly. Be kind of tough in a sexy way. Sit on the edge of the couch instead of getting comfortable. Run your hands through your hair and slap him on the back. Oh, Joel, you're a scream. I love your Roseville pottery collection. It's one of the best I've ever seen. Hey, don't worry. If I'm wrong for this part, we'll do something else together. I mean, I just dig you, and I really want to be friends. Drive a motorcycle like the kind Brando rode in The Wild One. It's de rigueur now, so get yourself a beat-up leather jacket, some used cowboy boots, and make sure your hair is really long and definitely do not wear a helmet. Drive up and down Melrose with a cigarette hanging out of the corner of your mouth and weave confidently in and out of traffic. Don't worry, you won't fall off. Show up a few minutes late and really rev your engines as you pull up for your audition at Warner Brothers. All the young execs will be scared but blown away. Talk about your record deal on Virgin, even if you don't have one. They'll believe you. Tell them you've been living in Paris, hanging out with Mickey Rourke, and there's a damn good chance you'll get the job. It's essential to develop some gay allies as well. Get in with the gay mafia, powerful producers, execs, etc. Fix them up with some of your really cute boyfriends. Don't worry, they won't have to do anything except act disinterested. If it doesn't work out, they won't blame you. They'll just ask you to find some more beautiful boys who'll reject them. Be a good friend and take their calls at 6 a.m. and listen while they cry the blues about how no one ever loves them, and you'll be a superstar overnight. Go to clubs, but not every week. Get everybody interested and then disappear. When you show up again, they'll be so desperate they'll promise you anything and everything you want, including the Mercedes 450 SL. And baby, you deserve it. You can date one of these guys, but make sure you keep one of his friends hanging on the line just in case. Alternate a hot actor and an older director, and maybe toss in a producer or two. And always keep an agent on hold. Get some headshots from Herb Ritz. Have Sally Hershberger cut your hair. Work out at Gold's Gym and sleep late. That's my best advice for you girls, you hot, happening, groovy stars of today. Play by their rules, and you'll never grow old.
That's Sandra Bernhardt reading from her new book, Love, Love, and Love. Sandra, when did you start writing?
Well, you mean originally?
Yeah.
I guess I was about 11 or 12 when I started writing poetry and keeping diaries.
What kind of poetry was it?
Haikus and...
They were really big.
You know, I mean, you know, in the late 60s, early 70s, haikus were, you know, essential.
Absolutely. And were your diaries confessional?
Oh, always. Extremely confessional.
And were they imaginative, too? I mean, did you make up things in them?
Yeah, well, I've always been, you know, somebody who's kind of mixed my own life and what I hoped would happen with my life, so they ended up being rather fantastical.
Right. I always figured when other girls, you know, young girls were, like, playing house or playing school, you were playing showbiz.
I was, actually. I used to go down into our basement in Flint, Michigan, and, like, run a business out of there and make up names of companies and stuff.
But like a movie studio?
No, there were more corporations. I got into the movie business a little bit later. But I did. I also performed theatrical productions in the basement.
Which one?
Well, specifically Hello, Dolly, because I'd gone to see it when I was 8 years old in Detroit when Carol Channing was trying it out. So I memorized the entire score, and I would put the record on, and I'd sing all the parts and drive all my relatives crazy.
It's really funny that you should emulate this kind of, you know, mature...
Yes.
Mature actress.
It was funny, actually. Very strange.
You loved Barbara Streisand, too, right?
Yes, yes. When I was young, I loved Barbara.
And what did she do for you?
I don't know. She had a sense of craziness and freedom, and she was kooky, you know? And it was great to be kooky in the 60s when you were a little kid, you know?
Did you identify with her because of her Jewishness?
Well, that was part of it, you know, certainly. But I think it was more about her, you know, just her sense of style and flair and excitement at life.
So did you always have a sense of what was imaginary and what was real, or did it ever blur in your mind?
No, I don't think it ever blurred. I mean, I just spent a lot of hours fantasizing about what my life was going to be like when I was an adult. And it's quite similar to my fantasies, I must say.
So what were the fantasies?
That I'd be whisked around in limousines and flying all over the world and, you know, meeting great people and being imaginative and doing, hopefully, good work, you know, and performing.
So when did you go to Hollywood?
I actually moved there May 5th, 1974, to be exact, for some reason. It was Cinco de Mayo, so I always remember that day.
So you worked, I think, by day as a manicurist, and at night you tried to do the comedy clubs?
Yes, that's exactly what I was doing.
Were you good at schmoozing when you were manicuring people's nails?
Well, I was certainly good at keeping these women coming back every week and, you know, and feeling comfortable with me. I mean, it's a very intimate thing, doing somebody's nails.
What was the clientele like?
They were mainly women 35, 40 and up, upward, you know, upper middle class, you know, housewives from Beverly Hills. Nice people.
So when you started off in the comedy clubs, I mean, you're not a traditional stand-up comic.
No.
So what kind of material did you do?
Well, it was like the infancy of what I do now. I mean, there were like little snippets, little like weird observations and asides and characters interwoven with little a cappella musical moments. And that was just something that was instinctive for me because I was so akin to musical comedy. In a way, it was like kind of a postmodern cabaret, you know, experience that I didn't even know what I was creating when I was doing it, but it was something instinctive.
How did it go over?
Well, you know, not great with like the club owners and the kind of people at large, but then, you know, slowly over the years people started getting into it and my style kind of caught on, but it took a long time.
You had several, like, turning points in your career. One of them was doing King of Comedy.
Right.
Another was doing your one-person show in New York, which was adapted into a film. Was there a point where you realized that to really make it, you had to go through a period of like, doing it your way and not trying to just get cast in other people's movies?
Well, it just seemed after King of Comedy, there weren't a lot of films that captured my interest. I mean, there's just not a lot of roles out there that seem to be right for me. So then I was kind of forced back into focusing on my own work. And since I'm such a determined person and somebody who really has such a strong voice, it just seemed like it was inescapable, really, that this was going to be the way I directed my career.
It's really interesting to me that after having this really quirky career, that you end up on America's most popular sitcom, Roseanne.
Yeah, it's strange, isn't
it? Yeah. How'd you get the part?
Well, I had met Roseanne and Tom at a party in L.A., and we started talking, and I was always a little bit envious of the way she came to town, and I'd been there for a long time, and she just got her own series, and I thought, oh, man, some people are lucky. But then I started talking to her, and we had a lot of similar, you know, points of view on the world. I mean, she's Jewish. She's from Utah. I'm Jewish. I grew up in Arizona, and there was that kind of, you know, detached experience we'd both had, and we really hit it off. I just thought, oh, God, I can't believe how great she is. She's like a really cool person. Then a few weeks later, they called and said, would I like to come on and do this character, you know, play Tom's fiance, wife. And I said, yeah, I mean, if I'm going to do any show, it would be Roseanne's. You know, I mean, it's a number one show. They tackle touchy subjects. And especially after meeting her, I just thought, this is cool. And then it parlayed into something, you know, longer and more... more permanent.
How did the plot twist came about where your character decided to come out?
Well, we were talking about it the end of the first season that I did the show, and I thought it might be funny if Jackie, the sister, and I had an affair because she's always going through a million different men and everything. But I guess they were afraid that it might limit both characters, so they liked the idea, but they decided to bring somebody else in for me, i.e. Morgan Fairchild.
Right. The kind of star you had not yet worked with.
Yeah, really. But, you know, the kind of star I was destined to work with. So that's how that happened. But, you know, I think we're moving on to other things now. Who knows where we're going this season.
So you're still in the series for this
season?
Yeah,
I'm going to do it this season again.
You know, the Arnolds have a really, like, public, confessional relationship with their TV viewers. What's it been like for you to watch the impact of that on their viewers and on them? Because you have this really public life, but most of what you do in public is not necessarily you. It's
right.
All these characters who you
yes,
are.
Yes, yes, personas.
So it's personas. So you could be really, really confessional, but it's almost always in persona.
Yes. Well, you know, I mean, when I really want to be honest, I try to expose the vulnerability as opposed to, like, really getting into, like, specifics. I don't think it's necessary for me. I think for them, it's just, you know, they're under the microscope anyways, and I think that they just enjoy it, you know? They're just very honest people. They're very comfortable with their relationship and, you know, all their problems that they have individually and together. And I just think that it's something, they like that energy, they like the turmoil, and something that they feel very comfortable with.
Sandra Bernhardt is my guest, and she has a new book called Love, Love, and Love. It's a collection of her short pieces. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Sandra Bernhardt is my guest, actress, performance artist, co-star of Roseanne, and author of the new book, Love, Love, and Love. It seems you're getting to live the kind of fabulous life that you've,
dreamed about.
Dreamed about and parodied.
Yes, 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 yes.
So I figure that this is something that you've both died for, but also had some contempt for.
Well, it's a fine line to walk, you know, because there's always part of your humanity you don't want to lose, and it seems that when you get caught up with a certain genre of people, it's threatened. But you know, I've been lucky. I've managed to meet the really wonderful people in unexpected high places.
So, what do you like and not like about fame?
Well, I've learned a lot of lessons the past 5 years since I did my show in New York, and I think the most important thing for me at this point is that I don't get caught up in misrepresented situations, things that I don't really believe in, but we're having fun with at the moment. But, you know, they have such consequences that you really have to think twice about presenting them publicly.
Are you alluding to your friendship with Madonna and its public nature on the Letterman show?
Yes. Well, I know it's not so much that, you know, of the content that was exposed, whether true or untrue, but just that it's really not about my work. And I think it reached kind of dangerous proportions of eclipsing my work, and the fact that I'm somebody who gets up every day and writes and, you know, prepares material and goes on the road. And I mean, my career is so eclectic and takes up so much of my time that I think it was really taking the focus off what I'm really about, which is my work, and what I love is my work. And the fame and the glamour and the byproducts of my work are things that are not nearly as important to me. And I think it really kind of shook me to my core and brought me back to my basic, you know, kind of desire to be me and my work.
What were the problems you ran into, though, that you're alluding to?
Well, just the kind of prurient interest in things that don't really reflect who I am on a day-to-day basis, you know, sexuality and parties and this kind of, like, you know, slimy, dirty, greasy kind of aspects of being in the public eye, which are to me, just nauseating.
Well, here's something I'm curious about, if you don't mind my asking. I mean, you've been kind of public about the fact that you've had relationships with men and women.
Mm.
A lot of people who are gay or bisexual in Hollywood or any part of the entertainment business are really afraid to come out, especially I think in Hollywood, because there's this whole thing that if you're bisexual or if you're gay or lesbian, that no one will be able to relate to you in a heterosexual role again. There's this real fear that a lot of people in Hollywood have about that.
Yeah.
So do you feel that this has affected you in any way, that it's hurt your professional, the offers that you get, or, you know, your credibility or anything?
I think that, you know, besides the sexual aspects of you know, of my life, I think that just who I am as a performer in terms of the kinds of bold ideas I present, the combination has probably prevented me from getting the roles that Bette Midler covets right now. But those roles don't interest me. I don't want to become somebody that can step into anything, you know? That scares me. I don't want to take away from my uniqueness. I mean, you know, I try to use my role models as people like Patti Smith, you know, people who have the courage to, like, leave completely and just go raise a family and then come back. And, you know, you can't take the brilliance away from an artist. You can't take the passion away from an artist. And I think at the end of the day, that's all you really have.
I guess if you don't mind answering this, based on your experience, do you think it is really dangerous for people in Hollywood to come out if they're gay or bisexual?
No, I don't think so. I think if somebody is comfortable with it, I think if they have a certain image, they're going to continue to work. And I think that things have changed quite a bit in the past 2 years. I mean, lesbian chic is, you know, apparently very in.
Yes. Well, did you see the Vanity Fair cover with Katie Lang?
Of course.
What did you think of that?
Well, for myself personally, I thought it was kind of trivial and kind of irritating. But I think in the bigger picture, I think it's great for the American public to see something like that in a weird way, because it brought humor to it and accessibility and kind of makes it just, you know, acceptable, you know, easy to the eye, I guess.
You know, I have a friend who wanted to write an article about you and pitched you to one magazine who said that they thought, this was a couple of years ago, that they thought you were maybe too peripheral. And then he was thinking, well, maybe Playboy. But he thought that you might be more interested in actually posing for Playboy than being the subject of an article. And sure enough, right afterwards, there you were posing in Playboy.
That's brilliant.
How did you get to do that?
Well, there's a wonderful woman there named Patty Baudet, who's one of the editors, and I guess she got the brilliant insight, and she called my people, and it just kind of came together. I was working a lot with a photographer named Michelle Comte, and we'd done a series of photos, and it just seemed like a natural evolution in the work we were doing, and everything kind of came together, and I think Playboy was really trying to expand their image and their audience, and with Christy Hefner, who's, like, a very cool woman.
What was in it for you? Why did you want to do it?
Well, it was a combination of things. They offered me a lot of money, and, you know, I always like taking money for things that are easy and I think, you know, interesting and kind of, you know, stimulating, as opposed to, like, doing a bad movie. I'd rather be naked in Playboy than be in, like, Kick Your Hooves Out Part 3, whatever, you know. I mean, it's like, you have to work, like, for 3 months for the same amount of money. It's not fair. No, I don't know. The money was part of it, but it was also something that I thought was a wonderful opportunity for a woman like myself who had posed so many controversial ideas to be in a magazine where people, you know, normally look at women in a very kind of strictly get off kind of way. And I think that because I got to write the text and I also got to pose in ways that were not just like I'm the bimbo, you know, I think it was good for everybody. I think it was good for men. I think it was good for their audience and it was good for me.
You're not self-conscious about your body, are you?
No, I'm not. Not in those situations. I am, in my private life.
You are?
Yeah, I'm self-conscious about everything in my private life. I mean, I think one-on-one in relationships is where it all really matters.
Why are you so almost exhibitionistic in public life and self-conscious in private life?
Well, I think it's much easier to expose yourself to big groups of strangers than it is to one person that you have a lot at stake with.
Mm-hmm.
That's why. I guess it's just easier. I don't know. You're not going to see these people, really. I mean, you're not going to really connect with them or have to deal with them on any emotional level. It's just kind of, you're putting out ideas and concepts and then walking away from it.
So when you go shopping for yourself, do you go to all the fabulous places now?
No, I don't. I go exclusively to my friend Isaac Mizrahi, who dresses me.
Oh, my goodness.
Because, first of all, for me, he's the, you know, his clothes are perfect.
Uh-huh.
They're made for my body. And it's so much easier than going shopping, and he really, you know, knows how to put me together. I just can't deal with going shopping anymore, except if I go to The Gap, maybe.
So that must be swell to have somebody who
it is.
Dresses you.
It's really spoiled me. Terribly. But it's a lot of fun.
So that's a dream come true, right?
I'm
sure you imagined that back when you were in your basement.
Oh, absolutely. Right? Absolutely. That was tops on the list. I mean, there are other designers who, you know, I occasionally wear their clothes who are, you know, also very talented. But Isaac is my dear friend, and he's just, you know, I'm his muse, I guess, in a certain way.
Have you met Barbara Streisand?
Yeah, I met her at a party or a screening in Beverly Hills one night, and she was wearing a big hat. And she kind of looked down at me, and the hat kind of fell across her eyes, and she just kind of nodded. And that was it. She wasn't very nice to me.
Really?
I was really devastated. I was, like, crushed. I was like, but Barbara, I love you. You know? I mean, you were my whole life. So that was very painful and disappointing, but I don't hold it against her.
Well, she's changed so much from the time
I
when
know.
You wanted to be her back in the 60s.
I think we need to get into a time machine and go back to 1963 to 65 and meet her then. You know, then maybe it would be a little different.
Sandra Bernhardt, her new book is called Love, Love, and Love. Here she is in a Diana Ross kind of mood from her film Without You, I'm Nothing. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
But I just want you to know that no matter where, no matter how far, I want you to be able to look up in the sky and wish on your lucky star. Because if you should ever need me, I'll be here in a hurry. On that you can depend and never worry. Ain't no mountain high enough. Ain't no valley.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Bosnia and Somalia have forced us to rethink our responsibilities to civilians caught in war and famine. On this edition of Fresh Air, we talk with Dr. Kevin Cahill. He worked as a physician for more than three decades in Africa, Latin America, and Asia, dealing with the human catastrophes that follow war and natural disasters. He's edited a new book on health, human rights, and humanitarian assistance in conflicts and disasters. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews a new book of literary criticism that doesn't spoil the magic of a good story. The essays are by novelist David Lodge. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. House and Senate negotiators trying to get more votes for President Clinton's deficit reduction plan have agreed to two concessions to fence sitting Democrats. The negotiators offered a bigger percentage of business meals and entertainment as tax deductible. That concession was aimed at Senator Richard Bryan of Nevada, who feared a smaller deduction would hurt Las Vegas. The negotiators also agreed to raise the income level at which people who receive Social Security would have to pay tax on their benefits. That compromise was added for Senator Dennis DeConcini of Arizona. Both concessions make it harder for Congress to achieve the deficit reduction of $500 billion over 5 years that the president had called for. Democratic leaders hope to get the compromise bill through Congress by the end of this week. Both the Missouri and Mississippi rivers crested today at St. Louis, with levee breaks in Illinois keeping the river lower than expected. As floodwaters start to recede in much of the Midwest, they leave behind billions of dollars of damage and many questions. Dave Cohen of member station KBIA reports.
Missouri Senator John Danforth toured flood-ravaged areas of the St. Louis area and central Missouri, where he addressed questions such as, should people and communities rebuild on the floodplains? And do current federal laws work? Senator Danforth says no.
When only 15% of the people who can be covered are covered, obviously the flood insurance system doesn't work. The buyout system doesn't work. And I think we should address all of those things.
Danforth also says cities and counties should be allowed to bypass current rules for building roads and public buildings in flood-damaged areas, including the bidding process and environmental impact regulations. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Cohen in Jefferson City.
Opponents of the nomination of Dr. Joycelyn Elders to be the nation's next Surgeon General vowed today to try to block approval by the Senate. NPR's Joanne Silberner has more.
Senator Don Nichols of Oklahoma was joined at a news conference today by Senator Trent Lott and representatives of several conservative groups. They object to Elders' liberal views on sex education, condom distribution, and abortion, and to some of her financial dealings. These issues were dealt with last week by a Senate committee, which for the most part was satisfied with Elders' explanations and voted 13-4 in favor of her approval. Nichols today alerted the Senate leadership that he will try to keep a final vote on Elders off the Senate calendar this week, meaning it wouldn't come up until after the Senate goes back into session in September. But Senator Edward Kennedy, an ardent supporter of Elders, wants the vote this week and continued today to try and schedule it. This is Joanne Silberner in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials gained more than 21 points. Advances led declines by a margin of 3-2. This is NPR News. In Brussels, NATO countries discussed American proposals on using air power to relieve besieged Bosnian cities, but the U.S. failed to get full NATO support for the plan. Diplomatic sources say the 16 NATO nations agreed stronger action in Bosnia is in order, but put off a vote until the issue is studied further. The United Nations has confirmed that Serbian forces besieging Sarajevo have captured a television station on a mountain peak overlooking the southern part of the city. But Muslim forces in central Bosnia have captured most of a strategic town after a fierce battle with Croats. Richard Carruthers reports from Zagreb.
The Bosnian government says Mount Bjelašnica fell to advancing Serb forces overnight. It now fears the offensive has moved on to the southwestern mountain called Igman, where 10 villages on its slopes have been burned down. It could be that Serb forces have launched a pincer movement on Sarajevo, because they're also closing in from the north over Zuc Mountain. There, the Bosnian army has been weakened by 10 days of bombardment. Muslim commanders say hundreds have been killed, some buried alive in landslides caused by shelling. Elsewhere in central Bosnia, it's the Muslim forces who are on the offensive, driving most of the Croatian militia out of Gornji Vakuf. That town could be a vital link between the land they hold to the south and the northern Muslim stronghold of Tuzla. British UN troops in Gornji Vakuf returned fire when they were targeted by snipers. For National Public Radio, this is Richard Carruthers in Zagreb.
The Lebanese army ordered its troops today into positions in southern Lebanon where they could prevent guerrilla attacks on Israelis. The move has long been demanded by Israel. The deployment follows the end of a week-long Israeli barrage of southern Lebanese towns that Israel accuses of harboring Hezbollah guerrillas. The troops are being sent into areas policed by the UN. The announcement does not say how they will work with UN forces. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Dr. Kevin Cahill has worked as a physician for more than three decades in Africa, Latin America, and Asia. He's treated people injured by war and natural disaster. He says he learned the humbling lessons of third world medicine, that politics and prejudice were as much a part of most nations' health problems as the diseases he was taught in medical school. Last year, he organized a conference on health and human rights in conflicts and disasters. He's edited a book of papers presented at the conference called A Framework for Survival. Dr. Cahill is president of the Center for International Health and Cooperation in New York and directs the Tropical Disease Center at Lenox Hill Hospital. He's worked in Somalia on and off since the early 60s. He was there when the American Marines landed a few months ago, and it made him think about the alternatives to military intervention.
Well, there were many alternatives. I think in the 3 years leading up to that intervention by 30,000 American troops, really very little was done to help a country that was visibly going into anarchy. We, having supported the dictator there, President Siad Barre, for many years and having supplied him with weapons, really had a hands-off operation. I actually was involved with a number of other people to try to convince our government that while we were using a military venture in the Gulf in Iraq, why could we not do a compassionate effort in Somalia, a neighboring or another Islamic country in the region? And there was no sympathy to that approach at all. So by the time we intervened in December of 92, the fact is something had to get done. Everybody was shooting everybody in the streets, and it was clear whether we really had to send in 30,000 American troops and whether we defined our mandate, was it to just open some streets up and open a port and get food out? I think the questions that weren't answered at that time and the sort of focus maybe a little bit on the media acceptability when you see starving people on television or read in the papers, I think there's a lot of desire on the part of the administration to do something at that time, to do something dramatic, and they did. And they secured peace. But 6 short months later, we're being perceived by many Somalis now as a army of occupation as opposed to a relief force. And I think there were alternatives in terms of diplomacy, in terms of supporting voluntary organizations. There were certain heroic people out there, but you may recall that organizations such as Medicine Sans Frontier or the Red Cross did not want the military to come in. I mean, they've always they've just found their own work is hindered ultimately by too close an alliance with military. So that while I think the military can serve a good purpose, no one else has the helicopters, no one else has the resources for immediate intervention. The fact is, there are many other entities around that, if supported, would probably do and could have done a better job there.
As a doctor in Somalia at the time the troops landed, what were your concerns about military intervention and how it would affect your medical work?
I was in a refugee camp at the time, and frankly, when they landed Mogadishu, most of the sort of people with guns fled back into the hinterlands, and as they did that, they certainly were coming upon areas such as where we were working, where armed bands would come in and steal all the cars and take the... there were lives lost on... not unnecessarily. I think, as I say, it was so late in the day that anything was done. No one really asked and involved many of the people who had been on the ground there for not only years, but really decades. I've been working in Somalia on and off since 1960, and there were many other people around who knew that country well, and maybe there were certain fundamental errors that we're living with now that might not have been made had they been questioned. For example, do you dignify warlords who were responsible for hundreds of thousands of deaths and make them the major figures in your conference, and then only discover 6 months later that you can't deal with them and then start all over again in a more aggressive military way? Do you spend as much money in 2 months of military operations as 3 years previously had been spent by all nations together in humanitarian efforts? Those are, I think, are the type of legitimate question that you can not only raise but probably debate profitably so you don't make the same errors in the future.
You make the point that you think doctors can contribute in ways that politicians, soldiers, and diplomats can't. What do you think doctors can do that the others can't?
Well, occasionally physicians who have worked for long periods, or health workers, I would say, not just doctors, but I draw on my own experience there, have a type of trust in communication that is just very difficult to match in any other way. There are suspicions throughout the tropics, very often justifiable suspicions of any intervention by big powers. History has told many of the countries of Africa and Latin America that every time a big power comes in under any aegis, ultimately they're the losers. They may be coming in with large amounts of surplus food or grain and nobody plants, and so unless these things are coordinated, the next year may be worse, and people leave and they go to wherever the next focus of attention is. So that while Somalia is in the limelight now, next year it might be Angola or Mozambique, and people know this. So I think there are lessons that physicians who have had, and health workers who have had the privilege of on-the-ground, long-term involvement, and understand the people and are trusted very often by the people at all levels, certainly at the leadership level. I think those that type of trust is not available very often in the client big power relationship that would deal, for an example, with an American diplomat and a local politician, or with a powerful American army general and a local military person.
Dr. Kevin Cahill is my guest. We're going to take a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Kevin Cahill, and he's the president and director of the Center for International Health and Cooperation in New York and director of tropical diseases at Lenox Hill Hospital in New York. He's the editor of a new book called A Framework for Survival, Health, Human Rights, and Humanitarian Assistance in Conflicts and Disasters. You're soon going to return to Somalia to establish an amputee program based on a program that you created in Nicaragua. Why an amputee program? Is this an outgrowth of the conflicts there?
Yeah, before President Siad Barre fled the country, he dropped somewhere between 2 and 4 million mines around the capital of what used to be northern Somaliland or English Somaliland, the city of Hargeisa. And then he bombed it, and the problem with mines is that they don't just serve a military purpose. In fact, in this instance, it's doubtful they had any military purpose. They were intended to intimidate the population, and they were dropped as they were in Afghanistan, Angola, Mozambique, Nicaragua, sort of indiscriminately. And people, as in Somalia, where their primary occupation is herding camels, they go out and as they take their camels out in the fields, they tend to blow the camels and their legs off, and it's a tragedy of the first order, and most of the victims, actually, in almost every one of the countries, are civilian, and the majority are children. And we felt that if we could get both a visible and a successful program going, that in this area of northern Somalia, where there's virtually no health services at all at this time, that we could take one specific thing and put legs back on people in significant numbers quickly. And I'm working with a technique called the Jaipur foot, based on an Indian technology of using a rubberized prosthesis that can be put on a leg in 20 to 25 minutes. And we're going to do this by bringing people from Jaipur up to northern Somalia, train the Somali, so that it's part of a project that I again feel deeply about, that the Somalis must be allowed to help themselves, not just receive help from us. So this will not be legs put on by American doctors or technicians. It will be using the experiences and resources that we can bring to bear to train Somalis to put legs on other Somalis. And then when the program ends in 18 months, hopefully that rehabilitation unit would be part of a revitalized and maybe a functioning health system, which does not exist there now.
Let me move to Latin America. I think the first time you went to Nicaragua was in 1972 after an earthquake in Managua. Mm-hmm. What was it like to get there in the wake of an earthquake?
It was pretty dramatic. In fact, it was very dramatic. The entire city was still quaking. I met Howard Hughes as he was leaving the airport, and I was arriving, so I'm one of the very few people who could say that. I lived in a tent with General Somoza for 2 weeks, which was an unusual experience, and I basically directed the health service of a city that had collapsed, and the principles were not difficult to imagine. You set up health services on the periphery, and you tried to get people who had been crushed or hurt in the central city. It was never quite clear how many died, but 20 to 25,000 in the earthquake. And you moved it out and you set up health services. I later worked in an earthquake in Guatemala where it was just the opposite. More people died, but you couldn't find them because they were out in the rural areas and the hills just buried them down under, and the center city was all intact.
What are the typical injuries you have to treat in an earthquake?
Mainly crush injuries, you know, buildings collapsing on people and trying to find people. And the panic, and in Nicaragua it was the corruption that surrounds a relief operation. All of the goods that were sent in were held at the airport and parceled off to various members of the Somoza family at that time. And that was, I think, the beginning of the downfall of General Somoza, because people were so just sickened by the awareness that in this great national tragedy, personal gain had become even more arrogantly a feature of that particular administration. And so during that period, I got to know many of the leaders of what emerged as the Sandinista movement. Many of them had been patients of mine even there, because it was a small country, Nicaragua, and the foreign minister, for example, Father Descoto, his mother and father were patients of mine. They had been ambassadors under Somoza, or Sergio Ramirez, a novelist whom I knew, ended up as vice president during the Ortega period. So it was all, it's a smallish country, and I think the role, again, maybe that's a wonderful example where you could serve as I have, as a physician ultimately to the Somoza and his family, and to Ortega and his family. And I don't think either one ever really, I cannot recall either one ever asking me about the other, nor would I have responded about the other. But it doesn't mean that I don't have thoughts about both, and that I could maybe share, as I have tried to in this book and in other writings, the experiences, and maybe to the benefit of my own country.
As a doctor, you want to make sure that humanitarian concerns aren't overshadowed by military concerns. In your book, you express your concerns that the United Nations' military efforts might overshadow their humanitarian efforts.
Well, this is a very interesting issue, and I think it's almost happening right before our eyes, because as the peacekeeping operations around the world increase, and these costs under the United Nations Charter are what are called mandated costs. Once the Security Council votes for them, the countries participating in the United Nations must give the contributions requested, or not requested, demanded of them for military. Whereas for humanitarian affairs, all are just voluntary. They encourage people to donate money. And there is a real syndrome called donor fatigue, or frankly, just not enough money. So if you're spending all of your money on military, the chance that you're going to be able to continue to provide voluntarily humanitarian assistance is almost zero. And it's getting worse and worse. I really believe that the United Nations, which now spends more on peacekeeping operations than the entire rest of the UN budget by about 50% more, is going to have to seriously look at what its mission is. Do we want just another army? Do we really believe that military solutions are going to be any more lasting in the next generation than they have been in the preceding 100 generations? Or should diplomats and humanitarian workers and politicians and military people not be coming together and saying, wait a minute, what can we learn out of the various conflicts and disasters that we've been facing? Where can we put a new system together and maybe truly evolve a new approach to foreign policy? And that's the theme that came out of that Framework for Survival symposium, which ended up in the book that you referred to, where very experienced people, Cyrus Vance, David Owen, people who no one can fault as far as their experience in diplomacy, suddenly are saying, Mr. Vance in particular, is saying, there is a new diplomacy that is needed. There's a new approach that has to be understood. And then experienced humanitarian workers, as I say, tired of being sort of encouraged and partially funded, but then not listened to, is saying, wait a minute, we're the ones out there. We know what's going on. And it behooves everybody, I think, to start thinking not of little tinkering. I really believe that it's the United States really has an opportunity to have an utterly new foreign policy based on something that is closer to what the founding fathers of this country wanted.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Kevin Cahill edited the new book, A Framework for Survival. This is Fresh Air. The United States is considering airstrikes on Bosnia. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what do you have on this shifting American policy?
We're trying to make it as clear as we can, or find out as much as we can, about what precisely the United States is willing to do. We also will be hearing from Tom Jelton, who is in a suburb of Sarajevo, Dobrinja. We're talking about how that town has been divided by the conflict. We'll have a couple of stories on the currency crisis, which is taking place in Europe as the united currency appears to be falling apart. And Mara Liasson will be telling us how the budget compromise that Congress has produced differs from what the president wanted in the first place.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Commentator Maureen Corrigan has an unlikely suggestion for what she calls spine-tingling summer reading, a book of literary criticism by novelist David Lodge. The book, The Art of Fiction, grew out of a series of weekly essays Lodge wrote, which appeared in the British newspaper The Independent and in The Washington Post. Here's Maureen's review.
In his comic novels like Small World and Nice Work, David Lodge has done for the literary theory industry what Upton Sinclair once did for the meatpacking business. But like most great satirists, Lodge is really an idealist. He's outraged by jargon-spouting English professors because he knows that literary criticism, when done well, can be mind-blowing. If this sounds incredible to you, go to your local bookstore and just dip into one of the very brief essays collected in Lodge's book, The Art of Fiction. I guarantee you'll get thrills, chills, and goosebumps, even though the only dinosaurs Lodge writes about have names like William Makepeace Thackeray and Rudyard Kipling. The 50 essays that make up The Art of Fiction touch on just about every aspect of what makes short stories and novels tick. Basic stuff like chapters and point of view, as well as exotic elements like magic realism. Lodge introduces each essay with a passage from a work of fiction he admires. So the bonus of reading this book is that you get Lodge's personal list of fiction's greatest hits over the past 250 years. everything from Jane Austen's Emma to Paul Auster's City of Glass. Lodge can wield a deconstructionist ray gun as deftly as any of his fellow academics, but he prefers old-fashioned critical approaches here. He's steeped in the history of the novel, so we're always learning curious facts, like why weather didn't appear in novels until the 19th century Romantic movement. Lodge is also a dazzling close reader. To give you a sense of what he does with even the most over-scrutinized writing, here's a snippet from Catcher in the Rye. Holden Caulfield is at a Broadway play and tells us his date Sally has just spotted an acquaintance. His name was George something, I don't even remember, and he went to Andover. Big, big deal. You should have seen him when old Sally asked him how he liked the play. He was the kind of phony that have to give themselves room when they answer somebody's question. He said the play itself was no masterpiece, but that the Lunts, of course, were absolute angels. Angels, for Christ's sake, it was the phoniest conversation you ever heard in your life. Lodge uses the passage to illustrate a technique called skaz, which is writing that mimics informal speech. Skaz, we learn, is a Russian word, though it sounds like a blend of jazz and scat, as in scat singing. Lodge shows how Salinger creates skaz by screwing up grammar, exaggerating, and repeating words like phony. Then Lodge meditates on why Holden's voice rivets our attention. Humor has something to do with it, but the real secret lies in how Holden always implies more than he says. Holden never tells us he's jealous in that passage, but we know it, and that adds to its pathos. In the end, Holden's teenage skaz seems as intricate as great poetry. Lodge concludes his essay by shaking his head in wonder. He writes, "As jazz musicians say, Holden's speech swings." With great gusto, Lodge also dismantles Hemingway's repetitions, Muriel Spark's time shifts, and Kingsley Amis's comedy. Knowing the tricks of the trade can sometimes ruin the magic, but that never happens here. After wizardly David Lodge finishes his lectures on fiction, you know how the rabbit is supposed to get into the hat, but you're even more amazed that anyone ever manages to pull off the act.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Art of Fiction by David Lodge, published by Viking. Fresh Air's senior producer this week is Fred Landerl. Our engineers are Audrey Voblaitis, Ron Barron, Chris Fraley, and Richard Parker. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Confessions of a Girl Gang. We'll talk with Joyce Carol Oates about her new novel set in upstate New York in the 50s. A group of five high school girls forms Foxfire, a gang dedicated to fighting male aggression with violence. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.